Sarah, we want to talk about Peter Attia. Peter Attia, Andrew Huberman, a bunch of these other, they're not really influencers because they have a bit more substance to them than that. They're academics, they're doctors, but they're coming to a realization that zone two training is beneficial. Why it kind of irks me and why I wanted to do this video today, they're talking about zone two, like this is something new, this new wave, zone two training, when in reality, anyone that runs cycles, any endurance athlete, they've been doing zone two since they started cycling, since they started training.
Yeah, this is like a major revelation. This is the new thing everyone's talking about on the internet. As you said, Peter Attia is kind of driving the whole thing. He's talking about zone two training, its benefits, how everybody should do it. And his content is getting a lot of traction, lots of views, lots of likes, lots of interest as to why zone two is so important and why we should all be doing it. Of course, you have been doing, and any endurance athletes have been doing it for a long time. And we've a couple of clips here. I'm just wondering, does Peter Attia get it correct? Does he hit the nail on the head with his content and how he explains it and what the actual benefits of training in zone two are?
There's so many people who have watched this. I think there's over 1 million people have watched Peter Attia's video talking about zone two. And some of the stuff is definitely right. Some of it is very misleading. Others we'll go through it step by step, but others, I just think the message is mixed because at points he's talking to very experienced athletes and at points he's talking to total newbies. And that's really illustrated right out the gate at the very start. Do you have the exact title of what this video is actually called? Because I think that's, when I read it, that was where nearly the problem started with this video.
Yeah, problem starting straight off the bat. How to train your cardiovascular fitness. It's not quite right, is it?
Remember that scene out of Alice in Wonderland where Alice comes along and she's like, where should I go? And I think it was the Mad Hatter or something like, well, or she says, which direction should I go? And they say, well, where do you want to go? And she said, oh, I'm not too sure where I want to go. And he says, well, any direction will work then.
Thank you, but I just wanted to ask you which way I ought to go.
Well, that depends on where you want to get to.
Oh, it really doesn't matter. As long as I can...
Then it really doesn't matter. Which way you go?
That's like a little saying that I've always had in my head when I think about cycling and I think about endurance sports, because depending on where you want to go, you're going to have a different route. So how to train your cardiovascular fitness, how to train your cardiovascular fitness for a criterium, how to train your cardiovascular fitness to run a marathon, how to train your cardiovascular fitness for a multi-day stage race, they all have very different routes to get there. I've trained with and been teammates with stage racers and criterium riders on the same team. When I was in America that year, we had kind of a split squad. And the training for someone that's riding road races and stage races is absolutely nothing like the training that the top criterium riders do. It's totally different. So to put out this generic how to improve your cardiovascular fitness, it's almost serving no one off the bat.
Yeah, I agree. I do think, to be fair, Peter Attia, his whole thing is longevity, and his kind of ethos is giving people the tools to live longer, and while they're living those extra years, be healthy within those extra years. So I think he might be coming at it from a longevity. And we know that in zone two, that this is kind of where a lot of that really good work happens, the cleanup process happens and the regeneration of your mitochondria. So perhaps that's his angle, I'm not sure, but that's certainly not how we kind of approach it in training and in endurance sports. But maybe that's kind of a take that he's, an angle that he's using.
And I know when we watched it together, one of the things that you drew, like, I don't know if scorn is the right word, but that you noticed straight away was the vocabulary in this conversation.
Yeah, I just didn't think it was very, you know, his opening sentence is, you know, I'm really committed to developing your cardiorespiratory fitness. And that to me is just going to have people turn off straight away because it sounds sciencey, it sounds confusing. It sounds like, oh God, I need to be hooked up to an ECG monitor here to like figure it all out. So for a mass audience, I think he's kind of scaring people off a little bit of what should be a really, really simple message. So that was my number one problem I think I had with it.
Well, it's like that Einstein quote, everything should be as simple as possible, but not simpler. And I always push for, as much as I can, for inclusivity in cycling and fitness, because it's already exclusionary enough. We have this almost different language in cycling where we call holes and we have a secret hand signal and message for pointing out obstructions on the road. We wear kit that isn't that welcoming. So around vocabulary, I think it needs to feel inclusive to grow the audience, to get more people into it. If his intended audience for this is somebody that wants to just improve their general fitness, which is what you'd have to draw from that kind of vague enough title, how to improve your cardiovascular fitness, then the language and the vocabulary needs to be inclusive too.
Yeah, I think when you go to marketing school, as I did many, many moons ago, they tell you to explain things like you're talking to a fourth grader. So I think fourth grader is probably like a seven-year-old or something. I think President Trump was kind of took that on. He was very, very good at that. And I think that they have missed that in this explanation. So I really wish they had kind of gotten that a little bit better.
You're trying to maximize the area of a triangle, right? So the triangle has a base and the triangle has a peak. And the goal is how big an area can I get? Not how wide, not how tall. You don't want one that's this wide and this tall. And you don't want one that's this tall and this wide. You want the max. The base is your zone two. The peak is your VO2 max. From a training perspective, the rule of thumb that is applicable for people like us, i.e. normal people, and the best athletes in the world is roughly 80-20.
Okay, I don't want this video to come across as all negative because I actually really like Peter Attia's stuff and I really like Peter Attia. I've watched him. I think I found him when he interviewed Lance Armstrong and then I went on and watched a bunch of his stuff on The Drive. So go check that out. One of the things he does get right on this is the idea of a triangle, where if you think about your training as the shape of a pyramid and at the base of that pyramid, you want to build a wide base. So that's your zone two training. And the wider you build the base at the bottom, the higher you can achieve the peak at the top. Joe Friel, who we've had on the podcast a bunch of times, is the first person, I don't know if Joe invented this, but he's the first person I ever heard talking about it. For me, he's who popularized in endurance athletes. And Joe has this analogy that you can build, if you build a wider base, that actually allows you to achieve a higher peak in the exact same as, you know, something in construction. If you have quite a narrow base and you only do base training for maybe 1 or 2 months in the year, that limits the peak you can get later in the summer. And the distribution that is advocated by Peter Attia, and this, another place I think he definitely gets it right, is around 80-20. So you look at your total amount of training time you have available for the week, and then you take 80% of that time and you put it into zone two training, and you take the remaining 20% and you put that into threshold work, VO2 max work. That's where I would take, you know, Humbridge with him a little bit. I don't think you take the 20% and you put it into VO2 max or threshold. I think that depends on what your goal is, to figure out what that distribution of 20% is. You know, maybe it needs to be all in, you know, neuromuscular sprints. Maybe none of it needs to be there because you're a time trialist and it all needs to be in threshold work. That's where I think he tries to oversimplify it and he ends up missing the mark totally.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. So he did get right, but there was a few things, particularly around cycling. He speaks about Tadej Pogačar and how he absolutely wipes the floor with all of his competition. That did not ring through in our last Tour de France. We saw that eye-watering performance by Jonas that blew him, that mopped Tadej out of it.
He is going to win this time trial. Jonas Vingegaard.
I actually think that, Peter Attia is getting a lot of his information from Pogačar's coach, and he does reference him a few times in this. But I'm afraid Peter comes across like a bit of a, and I hate to use the word Fred.
Don't be that person.
He just is trying to talk about cycling in a really authoritative way, and I think it just kind of fails.
I would probably do the same if I was talking to somebody about Formula One or something. I wouldn't have a clue. I'd be like, oh, Max Verstappen's wiping the floor or whatever, because I see him one series of Drive to Survive.
I don't really
know the reality on the ground, but you know, mainly cycling fans are probably tuning into this and they'll know it's a different reality.
Absolutely. Okay, I had to interrupt that there because I just want to give a shout out, a massive shout out and thank you to that person who's interviewing Peter for his complete and utter lack of energy and it seems interest in the subject matter. Oh my God, I almost fell asleep when he was talking. But yeah, back to the clips.
Anything that is steady state. So, you know, swimming is a great way to do it because you can really swim in a pool at a steady state. Running is a great way to do it because you can pretty much run at a steady state. Cycling outdoors is generally hard Unless you have specific, like Fiesta Island was a great place to train. I used to train at Fiesta Island because for people who don't know where that is in San Diego, it's where all the time trial bike races were. And it's just a 7 kilometer loop that you can ride on without lights or any, like there's no traffic or anything that gets in your way. But for the most part, like I wouldn't be able to do zone 2 outside here in Austin. It's just, it's too hilly and there's too much traffic and it fits and starts. I can do my VO2 max here because I go to a hill and that's my favorite way to do VO2 max is on a hill that's about a mile long.
So zone 2 training for me, it's almost all about being outside. The idea of doing zone 2 training inside, it's for climates where it's not really suitable to get outside. You know, if you're wintering in Toronto, Vancouver, where it's just minus temperatures all the time. Now, he does say that traffic isn't permitting him, so we don't know where he lives in Austin. Maybe he's, you know, he's quite time crunched and at parts of the interview he talks about only being able to get out for maybe 1 hour sessions. Maybe he lives in a very built up area and if he's only to do 1 hour, he's literally stuck at traffic lights all the time. But by and large, outside is where you want to be doing all your zone 2 riding because you're getting so much more benefit than actually just the physiological benefits of riding outside. You're starting to work on your bike handling, you're getting vitamin D from the sun. Being outside just cheers you up.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. He kind of goes on to say that he does all of his VO2 max efforts outside on a local hill. I would completely flip that on its head and do all my zone 2 outside and my really high effort, high intensity sessions inside. That just makes sense to me.
Yeah, I don't mind doing VO2 outside as well. It's quite controllable as well. Like we have a local hill that's what, 10 minutes and you can ride halfway up it. And that's quite a nice way to do it. Roll halfway up, your recovery is rolling down. One of the bits that just is very confusing for me in that as someone who's actually ran quite a bit in winter periods is he advocates doing your zone 2 work as a run if you can't cycle. Now, unless you're a very experienced runner, getting out the door and having any sort of motion that isn't a walk is going to stick you into zone 3 almost instantly.
Yeah, I think a brisk walk is kind of where it's at. You're going to very quickly hit your zone 2 on a walk unless your cardiovascular system's totally trained and you can stay within the heart rate zones. Yeah, going for a run for me is not an option at all. I think that is very, very strange advice.
Intense like jumping, because the sweet spot for VO2 max is kind of 3 to 8 minute intervals. So you don't want to be doing things that are so intense that you can't do them for at least 3 minutes. And so that's why I'd kind of hold off on that stuff.
VO2 max intervals at 3 to 8 minutes is heavy, heavy going. 3 minutes. Okay, so what I'd normally start an athlete out doing VO2 max stuff is around 3 minutes. So you have them 3 minutes working in zone 5, and then you progress it to 4 minutes, maybe 5 minutes. But a really tough session that I would do if I was going super, super well or when I was riding the bike full time would be 4 by 5 minutes. So I was really interested to hear about 8 minute VO2 max intervals, because for me, 8 minutes is, it seems too long to maintain VO2 max power. So I was digging in and I was looking for studies on this, and there's one, Randsted 2016, we'll link it below, and they were testing various duration VO2 max efforts. And the study found that the group performing 4 by 8 minute intervals showed the most significant improvement in both power output at 4 millimoles of lactate and VO2 max. The researchers concluded that extending the duration of the intervals to 8 minutes at a slightly reduced intensity compared to 4 minute intervals provided a better training stimulus for improving endurance performance metrics in well-trained cyclists. That was the only study I could find to back up the efficacy of doing 8 minute efforts. And the conclusion of that study, from reading into what I just read out there, it's actually not specifically improving your VO2 max. That's the most effective duration for improving your overall fitness. So I would go back to the very start and say, what is the goal? Like if you ask an archer to shoot, his first question is, what am I going to be shooting for? If we don't know the type of event we're getting ready for, if we don't know if we're getting ready for a criterium or a time trial, the type of training stimulus that we need to do is unknown. So we don't know if a 4 minute effort or an 8 minute effort is going to prove to be better. You know, if you are a road racer and you want to get in the break, there was a great study a few years ago, the name of it escapes me, but Hunter Allen and Andrew Cogan talk about it in their Training and Racing and Power Meter book. It's called A Race Winning Effort, where they talk about the interval that produces the most race winners across big data. And it's actually like a 10 second acceleration followed by a 3 minute zone 5 effort followed by threshold. And if you think about that in practicality, That's because you need a 10-second effort to jump clear your breakaway. You need 3 minutes to extend that gap between you and the breakaway. And then you need to ride threshold the same speed as the breakaway to bring it home into the finish. And that's why they call it a race winning effort. And then you can reverse engineer that and bring it into your training and do race winning efforts in your training if you're a road racer.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And I'm glad to hear you're not bought into the 8-minute threshold because I...
No, 8-minute VO2, not
threshold. VO2, sorry, because I had a feeling you were going to start prescribing those to me and potentially all of your coaching clients. That's really interesting. Yeah, you do need to be very specific with what you're targeting. I think that's kind of where Peter Attia kind of misses the mark in this video.
But what I really like to do is 4-minute repeats, 4 minutes on, 4 minutes off.
And on the 4 minutes on... Are you going 100% for the full, like how should someone think about?
Yeah, this is one of those things you have to play with this. There's a, this is years and years of practice to know what that feels like. So again, I'm doing this on a bike, so I'm looking at wattage and my watts are so low now I'm embarrassed. I'm not going to tell you what the watts are because they're so much lower than they used to be.
What do you think his watts were, Sarah?
I don't know. I'm a bit appalled that he didn't tell us what his watts are. Are we too shy to say what our FTP and our watts are in a session?
It's the only reason I tuned in.
And what do you think it is?
Well, I don't know. I'm guessing, look, he doesn't sound like he's a Cat 1 rider. But he is a big enough lad. Like he's not super, super lean. So I'm going to guess at 300 watts for his 4-minute efforts.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay, I would kind of go with that. But yeah, I wish, why is he so shy? Maybe his ego is too big to tell us.
What's your 4-minute power?
I actually don't know what my 4-minute power is. Do you? You're my coach.
I would say I would tip maybe 470 to 480-ish.
Yikes. Okay, let's move on.
But I know, I have a sense of what I need to average my wattage over those 4 minutes. So I might go out at 105% of that wattage. And it feels pretty easy for the first minute. If it doesn't, I've gone too hard. By 3 minutes, I'm very uncomfortable. And at a minute, in that last minute, i.e. at 4 minutes, I don't have much left.
Do you think that's good advice for how to pace your effort?
Yeah, I think it's really good. I think it's VO2 max efforts. What you see a lot of people doing is they go out super hard. Do you remember the way you used to ride a hill? If you came to a 4-minute hill, you literally ride the first 30 seconds full gas and then your speed totally drop, your speed power, everything would drop for the remaining 3 minutes of that hill. That's a very common newbie distribution of effort. Mm. As you get more kind of nuanced on it, the way I think about this is when I was doing pursuit efforts on the bike, it's 4 kilometer pursuit. If the first kilometer doesn't feel super, super easy, you're really in trouble in that last kilometer.
Okay.
You're going to lock up bad and you may not make it in that last kilometer. Because when the single speed gear, when it gets on, the track is a real momentum thing. And when the single speed gear gets on top of you, you just start going slower and slower. And it's a lonely old place out there. But I think it's a good advice. Michael Barry rode for Team Sky and he used to coach me, and his advice around these 4-minute efforts was go to your CGs.
Yeah. I think that's really good advice. When I first started doing them, I think it's a pacing thing, isn't it? Like, as you said, I'd go out, even on the Watt bike, if I was doing a session, I'd go out way too hard. I famously close my eyes when I'm doing a session. On the Watt bike, I don't even know how long left I have. I just kind of peer at the clock every couple of seconds and I'm like, is it over yet? So yeah, I think that advice is really good. I'm going to take on Atia's advice there on that one.
What a catch. Roadman, you know how serious I take my goal setting. And I know how serious you take it too. So whether you're chasing fitness or lifestyle goals, and you're looking for a powerful ally to support you on this journey, look no further than Huel. Huel has become my secret weapon for when I don't have time to prepare a balanced meal. It means I get the nutrition I need without sacrificing time or taste. Plus, it stops me from reaching for the takeaway menu. I always throw a bottle of this banana into my backpack when I'm heading into the city, and it stops me eating junk convenience foods that don't support my training goals. It's handy, it's nutritious, it's 22 grams of protein. It's perfect for athletes that don't have time to cook or prepare food before a training session. It's convenient, nutritious fuel at your fingertips, ensuring you hit your daily fueling needs.
Huel Ready to Drink has over 26 essential vitamins and minerals in every bottle, making sure you get 175 health benefits. Plus, it's made from amazing natural ingredients like sunflower seed, coconut, and more. And the best part, 8 mouth-watering flavors. My favorite's the banana. That's what's in my backpack at the moment. You can get Huel direct to your home by going to huel.com/roadman. That's Huel, huel.com/roadman.
The other thing he mentions in the video is using your kind of perceived effort that, you know, as even as if you don't have a heart rate monitor or a power meter, he really believes in perceived effort. What do you think of that?
Yeah, and this is where I kind of got those mixed messages, because he advocates that 8 minute effort for VO2 max, which is, from everything that I can see, if there is efficacy behind it, it's in super well-trained athletes. And now he's talking about the use of RPE. Now, RPE does work. That's rate of perceived exertion. So it's a scale from 1 to 10, 10 being the hardest, 1 being the easiest. So your zone 2 will put you in around 5 somewhere, somewhere you can hold conversation. And rate of perceived exertion does work quite well, in my experience, in well-trained athletes. Like, if you say to somebody who's been riding 10 years to ride zone 2, but you don't give them a heart rate monitor or a power meter, they'll land close enough to zone 2. But I remember lactate testing total newbies years ago. And so I'd have their blood lactate data. And so you'd be taking blood samples and you'd be looking at their millimoles of lactate and you'd be asking them how they felt as well. And so many times I would say to people, I could see they're approaching 4 millimoles, which is threshold. So that's 7, 8 out of 10 effort. And you could see they're approaching threshold. And you'd be like, what's your RPE? And they'd be like, no, nothing. And you're like, how do you mean nothing? And I was like, it's a scale of 1 to 10. They'd be like, okay, 1. I'd be like, oh, it must be more than 1. No, it's not 1, 1. And then 30 seconds later, they'd be boom, gone. And I was wondering, is that just anecdotal? So I went digging for studies and I found one from Sanders in 2017. And he found that cyclists' perceived effort, RPE, does not always align with objective measures like heart rate and power. Specifically, they observed the time spent in lower intensity zones was significantly lower when quantified by rate of perceived exertion compared to heart rate and power. Conversely, time in higher zones was higher with rate of perceived exertion. So this suggests that cyclists may underestimate their effort at lower intensities and overestimate it at higher intensities when they're relying on RPE.
That is just me. That study is basically around me.
Sanders studied you back in 2017. That's what happened there.
I have absolutely zero clue as to, when we are out training together, you're always saying, look at your power meter, look at your heart rate, because like, I've no knowledge. I don't know how it naturally feels. And I know I've often spoken to you about this. I'm like, would you know it, you know, your watts even without looking at your power meter? And you're like, yeah, probably within a range of 5 watts, I'd be right. So yeah, I think perceived effort is something that you leave to people who are a little bit more trained, who are more in tune with their bodies.
Thanks for tuning into this video, folks. If you enjoyed this, please click up here, because there's another one that I know you're gonna love along the same lines. And take a second to subscribe to the channel. This is not just a random call. Subscribing to the channel really helps us grow. It helps us get bigger guests and it funds the channel going forward. Thanks a lot.